Politicians. Fort George, New York. Timeline 3, March 2020. Julius found a surprise waiting for him at his destination. His boss, Colonel Jackson, had a visitor.
"Come in, sit down,"
Jackson gestured at a chair.
"Major, I believe you've met Mrs. Hurth already."
Julius gaped for a moment.
"Yes, we've met," he said.
Then he beamed.
"Nice to see you again, Brill. Colonel, Mrs. Hurth is my sister-in-law."
Jackson kept a poker face as Brill smiled at Julius. Clearly he hadn't realized it was a family matter, even though they were both world walkers.
"It's been ages, Yule."
Indeed it had been. He'd barely recognized her at first. She'd cut her long blonde hair much shorter and curled it after the current mode, and it was graying toward ash. She was also slightly dumpier than he remembered, and the crow's feet at the edges of her eyes were deeper. She wore a fashionable shalwar suit, the very model of a modern female party member. She extended a hand, and he shook it across his boss's desk, still startled to see her here.
"How are Ellie and the girls?" she asked.
Julius caught a very slight tension around Jackson's eyes and caught himself before relaxing into informality.
"Ellie's doing fine. So are Sophie and Mary and Rena. We really must get together properly. But I take it you're not here just to catch up?"
"Sit,"
grunted Colonel Jackson, looking rather put out. Julius sat.
"Mrs. Hurth, before your arrival I was expecting the Major to report to me about a matter I can't discuss in front of you. Julius, if there are no special circumstances demanding immediate consideration, we can skip the verbal. Just have a final write-up on my desk by first thing tomorrow morning, yes?"
"Yes."
"Is this about the Bronx restart program?"
Brilliana asked. Both men looked at her as if she'd grown a second head.
"Because if so, that particular report is due to land on my desk on Friday morning."
"Of course." Julius felt like kicking himself. "Definitely not a social call. Brill worked for Miriam, and this entire organization was one of her projects." Jackson cleared his throat apologetically.
"You may say that, but without confirmation, I can't discuss it with you."
Brilliana, formerly the Lady Brilliana Dost, in the days before the clan sought exile in the Commonwealth, frowned. It was an expression that struck fear in the hearts of braver men than Julius. Now she turned it on Jackson.
"The Major has just returned from excursion 18962, collecting this month's uncleared intel package from Paulette Milan," she said, speaking slowly and clearly. "His rendezvous point was the Blue Star Diner in Red Hook, New York. Colonel, your concern for operational security is noted, but you might want to bear in mind that to me, it's family. If you really want to go through the motions, you can query my clearance with the minister right now, but that will delay us and drag her away from her dinner."
Colonel Jackson raised his hands in surrender.
"That won't be necessary," he agreed hastily. "I'll go through the forms and get you added to my cleared list tomorrow. In the meantime,"
he winced,
"can I count on your discretion?"
"Certainly."
Brill's smile was bright, and reassuringly walked things back to just the right side of frightening.
"I note that the Trakan forecasts for safe transfer windows have been narrowing rapidly in the past 6 months. Yule, in your opinion, is Miss Milan showing signs of stress?"
"Is she?"
Julius instinctively glanced at the colonel for permission. He nodded, almost imperceptibly.
"Yes, she is. She's not requesting extraction, but she's clearly worried about detection."
"I see,"
Brill nodded thoughtfully. Julius felt an explanation was in order.
She has relatives, he said. Nieces and a nephew, he shrugged. Doesn't sound like much of a life to me, but it's her choice.
Unfortunately, began Jackson, just as Brilliana cut him off.
No, it isn't.
She cleared her throat.
We owe her a huge debt, but the longer we run her, the higher the probability that the adversary's traffic analysis will identify her as a person of interest. She's already one of our longest-running agents. Part of my reason for visiting you today was to poll you about the practicality of arranging a voluntary or semi-voluntary extraction.
Semi-voluntary?
Julius couldn't help himself. Brill's lips pursed.
I can probably persuade her to cooperate if I talk to her in person, assuming we're not already too late. But I think we need to retire her. She knows too much.
Julius shuddered.
It's going to be difficult. The details will be in my report, he caught Colonel Jackson's eye. But today was extremely difficult.
How difficult?
Her eyes narrowed.
I nearly didn't make it back.
Julius's shoulders slumped. There's no indication that they're on to her, but they nearly caught me on the subway. I had to break cover and run.
Oh, hell.
Well, that tears it.
Brill frowned.
I've got to talk it over with the minister and clear it with oversight, but I believe we're going to have to end her residency.
Julius paused.
I think you're going to want to use a different controller for that mission, he said reluctantly. I'm pretty sure they made me on the station cameras.
Colonel Jackson was frowning, too.
Just when we're short-handed.
Doesn't signify, said Brill. We can't afford to leave a compromised agent behind in the United States. Not with 17 years of accumulated breadcrumbs pointing to her front door. It would tell them altogether too much about our interests and progress, but it would set a really bad precedent, a terrible one, if we kill a loyal agent for no fault of her own other than being at risk of apprehension by the adversary. Trust is a two-way street, and all that.
Julius recognized the words. She was quoting the minister, Miriam.
We can lay the groundwork for an extraction, Colonel Jackson said warily. But I'll need a written order.
You'll get it tomorrow.
Is that all?
No, it isn't.
Brill leaned back in her chair.
Feel free to correct me if I'm laboring under a misapprehension, but Julius isn't due to visit Ms. Milan again for another 27 days. Am I correct? And he's going to have to be reassigned anyway now that he's apparently on their face recognition database?
That's right.
Well then, can you spare him for the next 6 months, Colonel?
What?
Jackson sat bolt upright.
You've got to be joking.
Let me rephrase that, Colonel. I'm in need of Major Julius Hjorth's unique combination of abilities, so I'm going to requisition him. You can have him back temporarily if it's essential to pull Pauly out, but I need him on an ongoing basis for an operation vital to national security. I'm afraid this comes from the top. Resistance, as they say, is futile.
I'm sure you can make it stick, Jackson grumped. But you realize that Julius runs 19 other U.S.-based agents? Not all of whom live in the middle of a camera hotspot. We've been hit hard by this damned flu pandemic.
Your sleepers have a protocol to follow in the event of a no-show, Brill pointed out. This is going to cause temporary disruption, yes. But I really need Yule.
May I ask why?
Because we need him for a little trip to Europe in Timeline 2. And he has, or used to have, a private pilot's license.
Palace of New London, Manhattan Island, Timeline 3, Spring, 2018. 3 days after the abortive assassination attempt, only the second in the past 2 years, the minister was unsure whether to be relieved or offended that she was held in so little esteem by the enemy. Miriam found herself back in her office in the Capitol, chairing yet another meeting. Revolutions, she'd long since learned, ran on committees, just like any other government, once you got past the screaming and shooting stage.
The price of leading a faction among the winners in the post-coup dogpile was an office in a government ministry, and by, a daily briefing that in digest form alone was several inches thick. However, an assassination attempt still merited a meeting with her head of security.
"On the subject of your assailant, my lady," said Olga Thorold. Her aristocratic youth in the Grunmarked timeline still colored the style of her private speech, even though it might have been seen as counter-revolutionary backsliding. Only her position enabled her to get away with it, unquestioned.
"I have a report from internal security on the background of the would-be assassin."
She reached into a side pocket of her wheelchair with one shaky hand and pulled out a slim document file, its edge striped in the yellow and red indicating its security classification level. She slid it carefully across Miriam's blotter.
"I find it disturbing by implication."
"Summarize for me, please." Miriam slid her reading glasses down, then pinched the bridge of her nose tiredly.
"Eye strain again," she muttered apologetically.
"Think nothing of it. At least my eyes still work." Miriam winced. When she'd first met her, Olga had been a willowy 18-year-old, to all appearances a naive, noble lady of the clan. Her role in life was apparently to make a good marriage and provide the linked families of world-walking merchant princes with a fresh brood of aristocratic couriers. But it had been a creative lie. Working as an agent of the clan's internal security organization, Olga's real role was far from passive. Subsequently, she'd acted as Miriam's head of intelligence during and after the escape to the revolution-racked new home in Timeline 3. But the multiple sclerosis that ran in the clan's bloodlines and had taken Miriam's mother now had its claws into her.
"Just the talking points will do, Olga."
"Certainly. Your shooter was a Mr. Michael Burke, age 19, born and raised in Boston. By employment, a postal sorter. Unmarried, no children, second youngest of six siblings, father deceased. No criminal record to speak of."
Olga shook her head. "We had no warnings about him, which is disturbing. He left his previous job as an assistant railway signalman 9 months ago, and his whereabouts were unknown for 2 months afterward, before he sought work with the post office."
"Hell." Miriam closed her eyes.
"Any leads?"
"Hard to say. Mr. Burke was not an associate of any known royalist clubs or debating societies. I cannot swear to his reading habits at the library, but he certainly did not subscribe to any questionable periodicals, and none such were found in his room when SCEP raided it. And they're cooperating with my people about as well as you can expect."
Miriam winced again. The special counter-espionage police were not her favorite people.
"I can't help thinking this sort of trawl would be easier if we had hot and cold running internets, cameras on every street corner, and carte blanche to wage a war on terror."
Miriam paused.
"Probably just as well we don't, come to think of it. If the previous regime had such tools, we wouldn't be here, would we?"
"You might think that. I couldn't possibly comment."
Olga's frown was eloquent. But then her expression brightened.
"I had enough leverage to learn that the specials found a ticket stub in his room."
Olga continued.
"The return half of an open railway return from Philadelphia. The issue dates matched when he was missing. What are the SCEP are proceeding on the assumption they're hunting for a sleeper cell? There's a certain stench to this that suggests careful organization. Not a lone wolf. They said they'll let me know if they uncover anything, and for once I'm inclined to believe them."
An attempt on the life of a minister was too serious to sweep under the rug, and SCEP would risk serious blowback if they didn't keep Miriam's own security team updated on the threat.
I have a contact there. For now, that will be sufficient. But it looks as if the royal court may finally have worked out who their real enemies are.
Ouch, Miriam frowned. The king in exile in St. Petersburg, capital of the French continental empire, was slow on the uptake when it came to matters mechanical. With the arrogance of hereditary aristocrats, they had paid far more attention to the Commonwealth's navies and armies than to their ministry of washing machines and higher education. But it seemed that he, or one of his advisors, had finally realized where the Commonwealth's economic and technological progress was coming from, and decided to do something about it at source.
Do I have anything to worry about? I'm doubling your bodyguard and putting them on 24/7 alert, my lady, and notifying your husband's department. Other than that, nothing immediate. Once we get confirmation, Brilliana and I will come back to you with some concrete proposals to teach them the unwisdom of playing games with us.
All right. Other matters?
Yes.
Olga straightened painfully, levering herself up against the back of her wheelchair.
Do you want the weekly update on operations in the United States first, or...
There was a push-button phone to one side of Miriam's desk, equipped with a bulky, transistorized scrambler unit. Right at that moment, it began to buzz angrily.
Hold on.
She glanced at Olga, then back at the phone.
You can stay.
Certainly. Who is it?
External, long distance. Encrypted.
She frowned.
Wait.
Her direct secure line wasn't public, but government phone directories were quite extensive. She picked up the receiver.
Miriam speaking?
Miriam?
The voice was familiar and welcome.
I have a sit-rep.
Hugh!
It was Brilliana's husband, the Explorer General, head of the department's exploration force based in South America, and of various other exotic assets, which were also based as close as possible to the equator, for reasons of orbital dynamics. Her chest suddenly felt hollow.
What's happening at your end?
Across the desk from her, Olga leaned forward eagerly.
I thought you might want to know before it makes the evening news. Rudy just called. Test 5 was a complete success.
His voice was shaky, as if he was finding it hard to control himself.
Dawn 1 is in the correct orbit, and we're receiving telemetry from the payload.
What?
She realized she was clutching the phone as if it were trying to escape.
It worked?
100%!
Now he sounded triumphant.
We finally made it!
Oh my! Oh my!
The butterflies made it hard to breathe.
Who else have you notified?
You're the first. Rudy's calling the first man's office, and I believe Director Kemp is on the phone to the Communication Ministry.
She could barely believe it. The long series of launch pad fires and explosions seconds after liftoff had been a never-ending embarrassment. Even though they'd only been trying to place satellites in orbit for a couple of years, and were barely 20 years on from fabric-skinned biplanes.
I think I can scare up a news crew this evening. Do you have a prepared statement you can wire me?
I don't, but Rudy does. I'll get the propaganda office to email it over immediately.
Hugh cut the call short. Intercontinental trunk calls were still hugely expensive.
Well,
Miriam looked at Olga.
Was that what I think it was?
Olga gripped her armrests.
Yep.
She took a deep breath.
They did it. Dawn 1 is in low Earth orbit and talking.
Dawn 1 wasn't just this world's first satellite. They'd gone for broke. The 4-ton behemoth was actually the prototype for what would one day soon be a manned vehicle. And then there was the other, more radical space program,
but that hadn't launched anything yet. "Sorry, Olga. I'm going to have to cut this short." She picked up the phone again. "Hi, Galen. Can you round up a news crew? They're going to want to interview me just as soon as they hear what's just happened."
"Yes, the USA is coming.
Let them come.
We'll be ready."
New London, Manhattan Island, Timeline 3, Spring 2020. 2 years later, Miriam was thinking back to that momentous phone call as her limousine, one of the clean, efficient diesel cars that were replacing the steam vehicles of yesteryear, pulled up in front of her current New London residence. As a senior party member, she merited a grand brownstone townhouse on Manhattan Island, within a mile's radius of the first man's mansion. The mansion itself was the Manhattan Palace. It squatted at the southern end of the fortified inner city of New London, near the southern end of the island. The city had been renamed multiple times, most recently in 1759 when the British Crown moved to the Americas in the wake of the French invasion of England. Miriam's brownstone was sited midway along a curving avenue, almost exactly where Washington Square Park was located in that other Manhattan.
"We're here, madam,"
the ministerial chauffeur said redundantly as she yawned and gathered her papers, shoving them into her briefcase. It was 11:30 at night. It had been a long day.
"Jack's getting the door."
"No need to wake everyone up for me." The door opened, and she slid out, stretching. She'd caught the newly electrified express train down from a plenary session in Boston that afternoon. The trip had taken just 2 hours, but the evening reception and the rides to and from the stations had eaten the night. The air was warm and damp. The faint, sweet, sick, open sewer stink from the Hudson River, fighting with the honeysuckle bushes, lining the front of the terrace of state houses. "That's all for now. Just make sure someone's here to collect me at 8 tomorrow before you go off shift." She climbed the front steps slowly and the door opened for her. Jenny, the housekeeper, had stayed awake.
"Ma'am? He's still up, in the lounge."
Jenny seemed uncharacteristically anxious.
"Thank you," Miriam nodded. "How is he?"
"Much the same."
Jenny closed the front door and threw the bolt.
"Will he be wanting anything?"
"A mug of chocolatl, if you don't mind, unsweetened."
Miriam paused outside the lounge doorway as Jenny took her coat, and heard an outbreak of coughing from behind the closed door.
"Damn.
Are you all right?"
she asked as she entered the room.
"I'm..."
more coughing.
"Fine."
Her husband, Erasmus, was sitting in a wing-back armchair, putting his handkerchief away.
"There's no blood, if that's what you were wondering."
"I was."
She sat down carefully in the armchair opposite him.
"It still worries me. And if you don't promise you'll see the doctors about it this week, I'll keep nagging you."
"It's not the phthisis."
"Tuberculosis," she translated mentally. He briefly closed his eyes, and for a moment looked a decade older than his 55 years.
"It's just a winter cough. The humidity disagrees with me. I know the White Death well. If it was coming back..."
There were two piles of document folders on the occasional table, one tall, one smaller. She picked the top item off the taller pile. "Progress Report. State Committee on Metropolitan Optical Fiber Cable Infrastructure, March, Year 17, she said lightly. "Year 17 of the Revolution, or 2020 AD in the old style. Just think how they'll manage without you if you die of tuberculosis through self-neglect, thanks to staying up after midnight reading reports." He glanced sidelong at the briefcase by her chair.
"I'll give up when you give up, dear."
A dizzying sense of drifting perspective seized her. I'll give up when the Americans, when the United States, when we're safe, in other words, never.
He spared her a sad smile.
You can't lie to me. I've known you too long.
Another dizzying look down from the pinnacle of the present into the yawning canyon of the past. I can't believe it's been 18 years already.
But you only said yes to me 14 years ago.
His tone was light, as if he was trying to make a weak joke of it, but the years weighed heavily on them both. I was still gun-shy. You would be too if your previous marriage was anything like my two. Her fingers tightened on his hand. Tell me what your schedule is for the rest of the week, and I'll tell you what to drop so you can make room for a doctor's appointment. Please?
You're going to blackmail me now, are you?
Yes. I want you to get your lungs checked out. Erasmus, I make a terrible widow.
On one condition, then. I think you've been working too hard. If I get my lungs fluoroscoped, will you agree to take a nice quiet vacation with me, my dear?
The door opened. It was Jenny, bearing a tea tray with two steaming mugs, which she deposited on the table before tactfully leaving them to it. Miriam picked up one of the mugs of chocolatl. Have you taken your pill?
What? Yes, I have.
Erasmus picked up his mug and blew on it thoughtfully.
Thank you. And I will see the doctor.
After the cabinet meeting tomorrow morning. I expect in the afternoon I'm going to be drawing up policy guidelines for how we spin our latest satellite launch.
Such is the lot of the Commissioner for State Communications. I should have been more careful what I wished for.
Space. The final frontier, Miriam suggested. Rockets are exciting, Erasmus. And for propaganda purposes, rockets that don't kill people are even better than ones that do.
Our adversaries are still terrified, though. Wouldn't you be, in their position?
Yes. She put her mug down and rested her chin on her right fist. The technology gap is widening all the time. We're at least 10 years ahead of them, more in some areas. They've barely begun to develop battlefield rockets beyond the gunpowder stage. They're testing a turboprop bomber. They've got atom bombs. But we've got nuclear submarines and sea-launched intercontinental missiles. They can't even shoot down our reconnaissance planes, let alone our spy satellites.
Yes.
Erasmus rubbed his forehead.
So I'm going to push the rockets for peace message as hard as I can. Otherwise we risk terrifying the French into starting a preemptive war, especially if they listen to our idiot exiles. Letting the former emperor and his family sail off into the sunset was, I fear, a long-term misjudgment on Adam and the Radical Party's account. It will come back to haunt us.
I'm not so sure, Miriam countered. What were the alternatives? Give him a trial and execute him? It would have created a martyr.
Another Charles the First, yes.
No, it would have been worse. Charles the First was a nasty piece of work. The rump parliament only put him on trial and chopped his head off after the third civil war he started. He deserved what he got. But John Frederick isn't in the same league, and we want to reduce the level of violence in politics, not inflame it. Convince our public that it's possible to transfer power peacefully. I've seen your polling. Half of them still don't understand the idea of a loyal opposition, even after 15 years of explaining till we're blue in the face. Executing the king would have set us up for a counter-revolution. His son turns out to be an asshole who sends assassins our way, and he still wants a monarchist uprising to put his family back on the throne over here. But he isn't covering himself in glory at the Dauphin's court, is he? If we hold our shit together for another 10 years of building microprocessor factories and jet airliners, everyone's going to see him for the irrelevant throwback he is, as long as we manage to avoid starting a fourth world war.
Yes, but in the meantime, he's inflaming passions at the French court, Miriam. A king in exile is a romantic cause,
and he can promise the more entrepreneurial Grand Dukes a continental ransom. Especially if he auctions off that pretty young daughter of his to someone with ambitions. Meanwhile, they're terrified of us. We represent the peasants on the march, every noble's worst nightmare. Worse, they know we're not just a mob of pitchfork-wielding yokels. They've read Adam's books, they've read mine. They understand that this is an existential conflict between those who adhere to the monarchical system and those who honour the new social contract. Equality before the law, liberty within the law, nobody above the law. They won't give up their privileges without a struggle, and they know it's a fight they're losing. Our satellites, he pointed through the window, indicating the southern horizon, are signs and portents in the heavens. It tells them who owns the skies. They can't ignore that. It's decades beyond anything they can do. He paused. How much stolen U.S. technology went into the space program?
None. We were very careful about that.
What?
The light was just bright enough for her to see his pupils dilate. Oh, we bought textbooks. Lots of textbooks. And it soaked up almost a quarter of our skills transfer program for 5 years. The STP recruited unemployed graduate researchers and teachers from Timeline 2. Their reach, in combination with X-Clan Worldwalkers and the nuclear submarines of the Commonwealth Navy, was global, and made them an offer they couldn't refuse. We hired rocket scientists by the double handful, mostly from Russia and Europe. And Rudy made sure Space Force ate their own dog food. We didn't let them copy anything directly. We've got a launcher that looks like an R-7, the missile that evolved into the Russian Soyuz system, and runs on the same fuel, liquid oxygen and kerosene. But it's entirely homegrown. We may have lost the first 4 launch attempts, but compared with the early days of the United States or Soviet space programs, Rudy's made amazing progress.
Well, that's as may be, Erasmus grumped. But I have to use it to enthuse our people without frightening the French into attacking us. And they're going to panic all over again when we tell them we're going to put an astronaut up there next month.
They pondered the implications.
Tomorrow evening it's the Guild of News Editors' annual ball where I shall be expected to speak. And, oh, the invitation should be in your diary as well, because wives are invited.
Wait, what about the female editors?
Yes, and their wives are invited too.
Miriam gave him a look. Erasmus's sardonic sense of humor could sometimes get the better of him.
The wording of the invitation assumes the membership are all men, he explained. The guild is full of deadwood because we needed somewhere to store it where it couldn't do any more harm. How would you like to borrow my bully pulpit to talk about equality? I'm sure they won't dare make a fuss. After all, the invitation was addressed to Commissioner Burgesson. They simply forgot to specify which Commissioner Burgesson they were inviting to speak.
Oh, you! Miriam chuckled. No, damn it. Picking fights with newspaper and wireless editors is... She glanced sidelong. You weren't serious, were you?
Oh, I don't know.
Erasmus drained his mug.
Sometimes I don't know my own mind. We are surrounded by bigwigs and stuffed shirts. I'd be delighted to see you tear into them, but...
He shrugged.
We'd never hear the last of it.
Enough of them seem to hate us, simply for existing.
You're a constant reproach. A woman and a tireless overachiever. And I...
He spread his right hand above his heart, striking a dramatic pose.
Am the henpecked husband. Merely the Commissioner for State Communications.
In charge of what had once been the State Ministry of Propaganda... Now with oversight of all broadcasting, film, and print media, not to mention the embryonic network of clunky mainframe computers that were destined to grow into the Commonwealth's internet.
Miriam, you terrify them,
The Ministry of Intertemporal Technological Intelligence scares everybody.
What was that phrase?
Creative disruption? Nobody is sure that your organization won't make their own pocket empire obsolete tomorrow, but none of them dares move against you, while MITI delivers the goods.
Just don't.
He paused to examine his mug. Underestimate the attraction of a little bit of decadence to old revolutionaries who think they're due their reward.
I don't, Miriam said tersely. She finished her mug of cocoa. Now I'm tired. It's been a long day. Come to bed, Erasmus.
All right, but only if you promise to consider a vacation.
She rose to her feet.
A vacation? We might be able to make some time for it next year.
No, Miriam. I mean this year. Next year we might not be here, or there might be another crisis. One damn crisis after another. Pretty soon you look round and realize you have no time left.
All right, she relented. Let's look into it tomorrow.
Tomorrow. But first, to bed.